Hi, everyone. Namul Milhud and Gaykil, and that's what we're going to talk about. This has come up recently, and it comes up occasionally, but I'm glad for the question. Somebody new to the channel asked, why Namul Milhud and Gaykil specifically? Why Milhud and Gaykil? Why not? I mean, these were sermons delivered by Shakyamuni Buddha in India, so presumptively they were Sanskrit or Pali. One thing to remember here, and yes, as I answered that question, these sermons of Shakyamuni have been translated many times over the millennia since his day. Notably, we talk about all the times the transferring of these teachings into written language, because none of these were scripted. Shakyamuni did not write this stuff down. In fact, he purposely did that because there was a huge amount of illiteracy in his day. The only people, in fact, who were really charged with keeping documents and even the structure of the language were the very elite, the upper class. And in those days, those were the Brahmins. And the Brahmins were the only ones, generally speaking, who were allowed to become or be in positions of leadership in the country. There are, of course, a history of challenges to that, blah, blah, blah. I'm speaking generally. The point is that because Shakyamuni was wanting to spread the methodology and the thinking and the mental construct in order to reach the level of awakening that he had achieved, Buddhahood, he needed, it was a universal thing. That was his whole goal from the beginning, before he was enlightened. He was seeking something that was universal in that, truly universal in that anyone, no matter what their life condition, whatever their state, whatever their position, their caste, and in India, that's a big statement I'm making. This is why he was quite revolutionary and quite disliked by the elite, because basically he said, whatever your caste difference is, you know, in India, a caste is you're born into a certain level of society and you can never escape it. That is your lot in life. And it's still that way. And so he wanted to teach liberation from suffering. He wanted to liberate people from their own restrictions in samsara, in humanity, so that anyone, whoever they were, whenever they were, would be able to use a method, a universal method, that would achieve perfect immediate enlightenment, awakening, which was egalitarian. The awakening of somebody in a low caste was no different than the awakening of an elite. It's very socially, structurally breaking of the day. So it's very revolutionary. But in order to teach that, he had to adopt a teaching method that was just as universal. If all he did was stick to the highest level of Brahmanist Sanskrit, and there were different levels of Sanskrit. There was an elite scholarly Sanskrit, and there was a more general Sanskrit. Anyway, I won't get into that whole thing, but the bottom line is he spoke all of his sermons. He didn't write them down, and the way that you learned Buddhism was, again, by teaching yourself through memorization. You memorized these sermons, you would repeat them back to one another, and you would recite them every day to help you memorize, and you would inculcate the teaching word for word, sound for sound. And remember that this was a language, unlike English, that didn't have this precision of grammar, that the precision in Sanskrit was very much a singing sort of logic, inflections and intonations. And, you know, you look at some of these Sanskrit words and they're darn near a short paragraph in English if you transpose them. So it's all about how the word is said, how the sounds of these Sanskrit characters formed an idea that you then shared with somebody. So the idea of sangha is built into the language. Do you see that it is the way and the meaning of the communications where the meat, the understanding, the insight is found? It's not in the specific words. This is why Shakyamuni so specifically told his students several times, admonished them, in fact. Look at the Lankavatara Sutra. The whole sutra is an example of this tiring of the same question in different form from the same person, finally saying, look, you're so obsessed about the terminology and the words that you're missing the entire meaning of the words. You need to focus on the meaning, not the words themselves. And so this is from the get-go, right? Now, to the point about Myoho Renge Kyo. Myoho Renge Kyo is the title in Japanese of the Lotus Sutra, or the Sadhamma Pundarika, right? That would be in a form of Sanskrit or Pali, right? But certainly vocalized through an English voice and intonation, right? I don't pretend to be accurate to the way that they said Sadharma Pundarika, right? That my intonations and everything, I have no idea. I don't know that anyone does, but we know how to spell it out, the phonetics of it, right? So here's the deal. Why don't we chant Sadharma Pundarika? Or why don't we chant, for instance, Moho Chikwan? Right, which I may be off on that as well, but that's a Chinese vocalization. And Buddhism went through a tremendous amount of scholarship and sifting out in China of those same original teachings, right? And China has different dialects as well, right? So does Korea, so does Burma, so does Japan. So why Myoho Renge Kyo? Well, idea of the sermons and their titles has been around since the beginning. In other words, if you memorized the Vimalakirti, if you memorized it, wrote, so you could recite it, then the very utterance of the title, the Vimalakirti Sutra, would bring with it the entire memorization and certainly, hopefully, the grounding meanings within that entire sutra to your mind, would they not? So the idea of a title being the embodiment of, as a container, right? When you drink milk from a gallon jug, if you know you've got a gallon of milk in your hands, you already know what all of it tastes like. You see what I mean? So the idea of this title being an invocation of the entirety of the teachings has been around since day one. So we also know from Shakyamuni that Buddhism was taught in stages or levels or periods of time to enable the capacity of the people of his day to deepen their understanding of how their own mind-body situation works, their mind and environment, right? These are deep concepts in Buddhism, and they spent a tremendous amount of time delivering sermons from different perspectives to get people to deepen their understanding. And in many cases, especially early on, he put a lot of rules and precepts around those sermons in order to physically force the enlightenment in people about how their body mind works. What's going on up here when you put your body through certain privations or restrictions? Body and mind work together. That was a big concept arrive at, even at that time for those people. Today, we take that more for granted. Yeah, body, mind, yeah, yeah, yeah. right? But then that was a very difficult thing to grapple with. Once they had that concept thoroughly inculcated into their reality, their perception, they could then move on to the next one. How could you control that? How could you find, where are the motivations? Where do these things come from? And how do we cease them? In other words, ceasing our engine of attachment in samsara, right? You can't get to that without understanding how your mind, environment, body are connected. So this is how Buddhism develops, right? So to teach the ultimate method for invoking your Buddhahood in this actual moment to someone who doesn't understand the way the mind works, this could be very, very difficult to embrace. Because in order to embrace something, we really would mentally have to commit our body, mind, and environment to it. But if you don't understand that connection, this could easily become a fetish and some kind of ritual and something magical. And Buddhism is anything but. So people didn't have the capacity to understand that in the former day. In the middle day, they were more intellectual, and the teachings spread far and wide of a greater amount, moving away from the earlier teachings. Not that the core essence wasn't in those teachings, but the methodology was not sufficient for people of greater intellectual development later on in the middle day of the law. So a lot of debates happened during that time to sort these things out, from Nagarjuna to Tendai Myalo, all the way to Dengyo, right? So this transverses cultures, it transverses languages, and a lot happens during this development of human capacity and understanding of what it is to become enlightened. Now, people were becoming awakened to Buddha in those time periods. It's not that they weren't capable of getting there. It's just that working with their awareness and their capacities, they were able to get there through more convoluted means, more different kinds of meditations, concentration and insight, as Tendai talked about. Strictly then, even then, focused around the Lotus Sutra, and even invoking the title, but not with the capacity to be able to attain Buddhahood, understand that they were awakened, simply using the title. So they had a lot of other rituals built around moving toward that enlightenment, that awakening. And then by the time we get to the latter day, our age, yours and I age, our level of distractions, our level of daily life, is so unfathomably massive, the influences that we're constantly getting bombarded with. This service, in other words, to our samsaric reality. Our attachments these days are so profound and so many that all of these other paths to understanding our awakening are simply, they're simply cut off to us. We need something that's more direct, more right now. Otherwise, we drift. We're adrift in knowledge, we're adrift in learning, and we're adrift in all of these wonderful conceptual ideas, but we never manifest them. Because our age is the age of greed, anger, and foolishness. Greed because we always want what's over there instead of realizing the Buddha within. We're completely dedicated to our greed, our avarice, our want. That's attachment gone crazy. They didn't have that much to want 1,000 years ago. Yeah, they had wants. But today, I mean, come on, can you go through a day without seeing something new? New and improved? So a must have? It's not just about commercialism, it's about attitudes, it's about ideas, it's about, we're attached to everything. So how do we sever that attachment? Because our brain, our monkeys, are innumerous. We can't count them all. And they're all screaming, me, 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 gimme, 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 gimme. How do we silence that engine of desire and attachment? It's not as easy. So we need a method that's far more direct. Now, he taught the Lotus Sutra, you know, 3,000 years ago, but when he taught it as another aspect of achieving enlightenment and the Bodhisattva way. And that was revolutionary in itself. It wasn't until much later in scholarship that the people were ready to understand that the Lotus Sutra was primary, that it was the ultimate, that it was the goal of all the previous teachings. And even then, people weren't ready for it. And that's why we have all these other sects and people saying, ah, the Lotus Sutra, you know, that's only for special intellectuals, or even denigrating it and saying it's a child's play, it's nothing of merit. Those people were at the cusp of the latter day, and they weren't ready. They didn't understand. It's now in this time that we're ready and we understand. We can develop the insight to go, I understand how an epiphany works. I understand an aha moment. And I need something that goes bap, aha. I you know, if something takes 3 weeks, I mean, you know, the P90 workout, yeah, that's really great for some, but I don't have that level of concentration. It may work for some, but it's not universal, and that's the goal, right? So the Bodhisattva, the teacher, the practitioner of Shakyamuni's Buddhism, who comes up with this insight, he doesn't invent it, it's been there all along. He goes, oh yeah, it's obvious. With all of his study of all of Buddhist texts and commentaries and Shakyamuni's sermons and the rules, precepts, all of that. He studies all of it as a monk since he's 12 years old. And at the age 30, he goes, I got it. Myoho Renge Kyo. Tendai said it. He just didn't practice it because other stuff, it wasn't the right time. Miao Lo knew it in his heart, but he taught it not as the practice, but as the law, the way, the reason of the practice. So the Tendai, all these scholars knew it. Dengyo certainly knew it. And for a time, that was the Tendai school. But they didn't teach it as the sole means of practice. They did. The people in their era weren't ready to practice that way. It would have confused them. It wouldn't have satisfied them. It wouldn't have taken them to the realization. But now, in this day and age, this is the right teaching and the right time for our capacity. Namo Myoho Renge Kyo, that's what we have to do. It's obvious. So why Myoho Renge Kyo? Well, yes, it's Japanese, a Japanese phonetic representation of characters that go through kanji and calligraphy in China, all the way back to Sanskrit and Pali, right? The characters themselves aren't the important thing in their form, although Tendai spent a lot of time investigating their forms and how specialized they were. Because when you look at this mandala, it's not Japanese. There's Japanese kanji in it, but it's very stylized. It has Chinese calligraphy in it, and it has Sanskrit. It's all a collection of ideas. And in the entire history of Shakyamuni's transmission through this lineage to today. So it's important to understand that. And this is why in the center is the title of the Lotus Sutra, the Saddharma Pundarika Sutra. But Nichiren signs it. Why? Because Nichiren is the scholar of the day who makes this the central point of practice that will bring anyone to awakening their Buddha nature, no matter their life condition, no matter their status. And because that insight occurs with Nichiren in Japan in this latter day, we chant Namo Myoho Renge Kyo as that ultimate realization that takes us throughout the entirety of the scholarship of Shakyamuni Buddha. These characters, these personages on this mandala are from the text of the Lotus Sutra. And if you read and study the Lotus Sutra, and by that I mean other sutras on which the Lotus Sutra sits upon and culminates in an ultimate practice, you will understand that those characters represent the depth of the teachings, because the Lotus Sutra represents the depth of the teaching. It just puts a final amassing logic and culminating truth to all of it. So by chanting Namo Myoho Renge Kyo, dedication and determination and resolve in the Lotus Sutra, the Sadharma Buddha, by whatever name you want to give it, here Myoho Renge Kyo, those characters represent not just Japanese, not just the title in Japanese, not just the characters, but the very identity of the teachings throughout the entire lifetime of Shakyamuni. So this is why we chant Namu Myoho Renge Kyo. Because it's not that the words are magical. It's because the words are modern anchors for our invocation of timelessness, Buddhaness, clarity of experience and perception. All nine consciousnesses awakened to the true nature of this moment, of this process that we call life, of which we're just a little glimpse into, like little monoculars, all looking at this same amazing, timeless thing. Changes our perception, changes our understanding, clears out of the way all of the supermarket of ideas that are constantly barraging us, shuts up all those monkeys in the head, in our head, so that we can see without obfuscation, without erroneous influences, desires, attachments. Now I understand. Hanging on to that moment is the most difficult thing. Achieving it is the first difficulty. Difficult to understand. Myoho Renge Kyo. But once you feel it, and you will, all you want to do is stay in it. It affects every other thought you have as you re-enter samsara, right? Namo Myoho Renge Kyo. I hope that answers your question. Ultimately, that's a simplistic answer. I think it's a good answer, but if you're anything like me, that will satisfy you for a brief period, and then your curiosity, your monkeys will just get the best of you. And you will have to research it. But I promised you this, because it happened to me. The more you research it, the more you'll start to get it. The more it'll become obvious. It has to be Myoho Renge Kyo. But if it motivates you to study and research more, that's good too, because that's an integral part of your path to understanding your Buddha wisdom to enable your invocation of Buddha. We all have our own individual, unique path of perceptive filters that we have to clear. So, good on you. Thanks for listening. I hope this helps a bit. If I raise some questions or some aha, or some of you want to discuss it amongst yourself, use that comment section. That's what it's for. I keep an eye on the comments because they help me tailor my videos, my future videos, to subjects that I may, in my own realizations, I don't have every path of the billions of humans on the planet. So something may come up in the comments. I never considered that. And that'll give me something to study and something to chant about. And then, if I feel that I have something to contribute, I'll make a video about it. Thank you again for being here. I deeply appreciate you guys. Download the podcast. They're very convenient and they're free. So have a great time with that, and I'll see you in the next one. Bye-bye.